Hello, my spooky friends.
My name is Cassie.
And I'm Caitlin.
And welcome in to I'd Survive.
So, the horror world. I don't know about you. I've only watched like one horror movie since the last time that we talked. I watched a movie on Netflix called Run, Rabbit, Run. I don't know if you've heard of this.
I've only heard of like, isn't that a song? It's like, run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run. It's from a Jordan Peele movie. I don't know.
I believe you. I don't know what you're talking about, but I believe you.
You might know it. It's a really creepy song.
This movie was like so good until it wasn't. I was loving it. Not because it was good. Like the vibes were great, but then it went nowhere and I was really disappointed in the end. Either way, it wasn't going to be a podcast episode because it just like wasn't going to work.
Was it older?
No, it's a much newer film.
Interesting.
Did you consume any horror?
I watched one horror movie on my flight back here. I was out on a trip to Pennsylvania. And on my flight back, I watched this movie called Possum from like 2018. It's PG-13, but only because it doesn't go there in the sense of like, you know, swearing and like gore and everything like that. But it was one of the more disturbing movies I've ever seen. And I was like, should this be PG-13? Like, don't know. But
interesting.
It was like, it's hard to describe. I wouldn't recommend watching it on a plane because it also was like this really spooky movie in terms of its sound design, like ambiance. There were multiple times where I had to like take out my headphones and make sure that the plane was like not breaking because I like couldn't tell where the audio was coming from. It was so overwhelming. But it was dark. It was like very one of those like symbolic movies and reveal at the end movies, and I don't want to talk about it like at all because you just got to watch it to get it, but I want to mention it because if anyone out there has seen that movie, you get how I feel. And it's not great. I don't feel great after that one.
Well, now I have to watch it. Like, I just have to now.
I mean, good luck. Yeah, you'll be fine.
I look forward to it. Today, though, today we're going to talk about a movie called There's Someone Inside Your House, which is a 2021 film, but it is actually based on a 2017 novel, which I did not know until after watching another novel movie.
Always love that.
This novel was written by a woman named Stephanie Perkins, and the film was directed by Patrick Bryce and adapted for screen by Henry Gayden. Now, do you know who Patrick Bryce is?
No, I don't think so.
He is the director of Creep, Creep 2, and Creep Tapes.
Wait,
one of our faves.
Oh my God. No, Caitlin's an OG with that. She's the reason I love those movies as much as I do. You still need to watch that series.
I know. Creep Tapes is on my list. Creep Tapes is absolutely on my list.
Are you going to like, is that like a possibility for reactions? Because it's like.
No, it might be.
Maybe. I think just because of your channel and like your vibe, you could make like people would love that. I've not seen like any reactions to it though. Okay, let me not fangirl. I'll reel it in. No, that's really exciting. Is this found footage or is this just?
It is not. No.
Okay, interesting.
Yes. And what actually the producers on this are, I'm going to say the last name wrong. Sean Levy is Ellie.
Yes.
No, and he's James. Huge. And James Wan.
Oh my God.
she's listening.
No, I love Sean Levy. He's like, obviously now he's like really known for Stranger Things, but he's like done so much. And he's just like a part of so much that I don't even know because he's been everywhere. And obviously James Wan.
Obviously like producers don't necessarily mean much when it comes to the creative aspects of things, but it's still cool to see their names on it.
Yeah. Like I trust like their judgment to be a part of a project. I'm like, okay, if they deem it good, like I'm interested. No, I'm hooked.
Yay. I'm glad you're hooked before we even started. But here we go. We open up on a still shot of a yellow home. This is a house that's giving farmhouse vibes. It's pretty much in the middle of nowhere, like dirt surrounding the house kind of vibes. And the sun is setting. It's very peaceful. Until a red beat up pickup truck comes whipping into frame and the car pulls up to the house and parks. Out gets your stereotypical looking high school jock named Jackson. He's got the varsity jacket on. You know exactly the guy that I'm talking about.
I fear I'm picturing Hannah Montana's brother.
That works. You know what? We'll use him. I love that. Perfect.
Just put him in a varsity jacket.
Perfect. He walks into the house to the sound of his phone ringing, and he has that duck ringtone, which I don't know why people use.
Oh, okay.
You know the quacking ringtone?
I've never heard a quack ringtone. Oh,
my gosh.
Thankfully, question mark.
I know most of you know what I'm talking about, right? The quack ringtone. It's horrible. Anyway.
Ugh. Sounds horrible.
Yeah. So Jackson picks up his phone and begins talking to a guy named Macon, like bacon with an M,
okay,
which is a name I didn't know existed. This conversation starts with Macon saying, Amber told Stacy she was down to do some nasty shit with you after the game. It evolves into some just like icky male conversation about how Jackson would never do that, not for $1 million with her. And they're talking about how she's like flat chested and just standards that they have. It's very, it's fun. It's great. You know, gross. We're just like, oh, so happy to be here. Jackson pauses when he notices an egg timer clicking on the counter. You know, like those timers shaped like eggs.
Yeah.
One of those. And it's random. Just clicking on the counter. And he calls, you know, to the rest of the house like, hello, mom? Like, is anybody home? But nobody responds. And so he just goes back to his phone conversation.
Okay.
Jackson heads upstairs to his room and tells Macon that he's going to take a nap before the game tonight. He sets his alarm on his phone, places it on his bedside, and goes to sleep. Our next shot is just a still shot from outside the house, the same one we had before, but it's dark out. So this is just some time has passed. Back in Jackson's room, he's still asleep, but the egg timer is now ticking on his nightstand.
Ew. Oh my god, okay.
The alarm goes off and Jackson wakes up confused, obviously. And
no, I have to stop. I have to stop.
Yes,
I have to stop.
What's up? What's up? What's up?
What would you do? What would you do? Oh my god. No, he's in a house though with people. Like, it's different if it was us and like that happened in a house where we are alone.
Well, I mean, nobody's home right now.
Should be, but if I was him, I'd be like, maybe someone's home and messing with me.
That's true. That's true. I would, yeah, you're right. That's what I would probably think.
Yeah, if I was him, I'd be like, someone is here. Someone from my family, obviously, is home and just messing with me. If that happened in my freaking house.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my God, I would jump out a window.
But what's fun is you'll have another opportunity in a few lines here to expand upon what you would do.
Oh no.
So Jackson looks at the egg, obviously wondering like, what the heck, how did this get here? But he's like, oh my god, I'm late. So he jumps out of bed, grabs his stuff, and runs downstairs. But when he gets to the front door, it is wide open.
Ew.
So now it's like, okay, well, that's weird, right?
Yeah, it's off.
That's super strange.
That's not just like a family member.
No. And then it gets weirder.
Oh.
He walks outside and realizes his truck is gone. He pats his pockets for his phone, but he doesn't have that either.
Oh my god. Ew, like as in his phone was in his pocket, I would assume, while he was napping.
No, it was on the nightstand because he had set the alarm.
Oh,
and
sure, okay.
They swapped out the phone and the egg timer.
Okay. And this house, like, are we like total middle of nowhere or is it? Oh, good. Okay.
Yes. Very much like in the middle of a farm kind of vibes and like there's nothing around.
It's giving strangers.
Right?
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah. Not for him.
No, not for him, but for me. I love it. So Jackson runs back inside the house, slams the door, and locks it. But this is when we get the title card for There's Someone Inside Your House, which is so good because it's like right after he runs in and locks the door.
Yes.
It's so well timed and
why am I sweating? This is like the most anxious I've been with like an opener from any movie you've done on here.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I hate that trope, like locking yourself in with someone.
Yes.
That's a trope.
Right? Inside the house, Jackson actually, he picks up the phone. Dials 911.
Okay.
And while
this is present day as well.
I
Because he's got like his own phone, like cell phone.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Present day.
Present day. I was like, I meant to check that. I think, yeah, present day-ish.
Yeah.
So while the phone's ringing, while he's calling 911, he turns and sees a picture hanging on the cupboard. He doesn't look happy to see this picture. In the photo, two guys stand next to each other in a kind of like, you know, arms around each other embrace, giving the energy of like drunk football party.
Okay.
And we hear eventually the 911 operator pick up, say, you know, 911, what's your emergency? Yeah. And Jackson hangs up the phone.
Why the fuck? Mm-hmm. Why? Maybe he like thinks he knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. Clearly, he thinks he knows what's going on. I don't know why looking at that picture made him think. I'm stressed. Go on.
He snatches this picture off the cupboard, crinkles it up, and the phone's ringing now, but he ignores it. It's probably 911 calling back because, you know, they do that now.
Yeah.
He turns and looks at another cupboard, and there's another photo from what seems like the same night. It's him and another person doing a keg stand.
Oh, it's not supposed to – they're not supposed to be there.
Yes, these are pictures that he didn't put. Yes, sorry.
Oh,
these
my are God. It pictures, just clicked.
Yes, these pictures are hung up by somebody else.
Oh, my God. Someone's got to be out for revenge. Something happened that night.
Right.
Okay.
So he stares at this photo before snatching that as well. And when he turns to look up the stairs, he notices that there are more photos plastered on the walls leading up the stairs.
Wait. So, oh my God. I need to stop.
She's so excited.
So he was upstairs, right? Like and napping. And then he came downstairs before.
I do think it was a different staircase.
Okay. So it's not like this was just put up in the last, right. Like, okay.
Yeah, no, that's a fair question because I was thinking the same thing and then I realized I think it's a different staircase.
Got you.
So he lets out like a shit before running upstairs to find, you guessed it, more photos. At first, these photos seem to be fairly innocent, drunk party photos, but then they get more interesting. We see a couple of photos of a guy with either a bag or a sheet or something over his head while other guys are grabbing at him. The photos lead Jackson to what looks like his parents' bedroom, and he opens the door to see nothing.
Okay.
But then he hears the quacking ringtone coming from the closet.
Oh. Do you go?
Hell no.
No. I'm already running out the door. I'm like, just run. I know my car is not there, but you just got to run. Like, right. This is clearly like you're walking into what they want you to walk into.
Right. So lucky for Jackson, it seems that his dad keeps his golf clubs in his bedroom next to his dresser. So sure. He goes ahead and grabs one of those, which like, good on you. That's a good move.
It's good.
He heads to the closet with the golf club raised and says, whatever little game this is, whatever you think you know, you don't know shit. Jackson opens the closet door to see, of course, more photos. These photos are much darker. In the primary photo that we see, there's a guy with a sheet over his head, and the front of the sheet is covered in blood.
Oh.
And we see another photo of Jackson with his fist raised and covered in blood as though he is over this person and punching them.
Okay. I don't know why, but the sheet over the head?
Mm-hmm.
It's giving like initiation. It's giving like frat boy initiation. Is he? Do you know if he's supposed to be like high school, college?
High school.
Okay.
Jackson hears a sound in the closet while he's in there. This is like a pretty big closet, and he just swings the golf club kind of randomly at the clothes, and he just wants, you know, to let this person know that like they're in his house. He can legally kill them. He says, which. He's probably not wrong about. So it's at this moment, that we see a knife coming out from behind some clothes in the closet. Jackson does not see this knife because
there's actually someone in the closet right now. How does he not see them? How did they not get whacked?
To be fair, like it's a huge. Big closet.
Yeah.
And they're like tucked behind some stuff.
Okay.
But let me set this up for you because this knife is coming out from behind some things, level with the ground, about 2 inches off the ground.
Oh.
So the shot is set up so we see the back of Jackson's ankles.
Oh my God. Oh
my God. And the knife heading straight for them. I have watched this scene 3 times and all 3 times I have covered my eyes because I can't. I cannot do it.
No, I can't with ankle stuff. I don't know why I have it in my head, like that fear of like people being under your car and like,
yes,
getting a tendon, because like I know that that like just immediately just you're out the game if they hit an ankle tendon or whatever the scientific name is. So I get you. Like, I'm so sensitive to that specifically as well.
Yeah, I can't watch this part, but I do know that he rips through both of his ankles and
oh my
blood
God.
Spews everywhere.
We have to be like 10 minutes in. What's going on?
I know, it's insane. So Jackson is obviously screaming. He's on the ground. He's offering money, anything. Nobody needs to know about this. And we then get a shot of this person who's now standing over Jackson.
Ooh.
They're wearing an outfit that looks about exactly the same as what Jackson is wearing at the moment. And the killer is also wearing a very realistic looking mask of Jackson's face. Jackson's trying to talk his way out of this, saying it wasn't what it looked like. It was just a team bonding thing. You know, that's not who I am.
Mm-hmm.
The killer doesn't listen, though. Stabs him right in the chest. Jackson goes limp and dies. One down.
Oh, my God. I thought this is not what I expected.
No.
I thought we were going to be playing like cat and mouse with Jackson for the whole movie.
Really?
So now I'm like, what are like family members just going to keep? This person's just going to kill their whole. Like, I get the motive here. Like, clearly they don't like what Jackson did that night.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, I'm going to get you. But then if we're going to stay in this house, like, are they just going to pick off the rest of the family members? Like, what did they do? What if they maybe they all have skeletons in their closet?
Ooh.
I don't know. That was wild.
I know. So Jackson's ringtone goes off again, and the killer pulls Jackson's phone out of his own pocket, and the caller ID says, Dad. Well, Dad is at the football game with Jackson's mom and sister, and he looks at his wife and says, I'm sure he'll show up. This isn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
Down on the field, a player on Jackson's team is running in for a touchdown when suddenly everybody's phones start dinging in the crowd. They have all received a video of Jackson beating up this other kid.
Oh.
The kid on the field runs in for the touchdown to complete silence. When he turns and looks at the stands, everybody's looking at him. He takes off his helmet and we realize it's him.
Okay.
He's the kid getting beat up in the video.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting, like, suspect out
type
of situation, you know, because he would be an obvious answer as to, like, someone getting revenge if it was him that was done to.
Right.
Okay.
So this is actually when we fade into the opening credit sequence with like a full-blown opening credit sequence.
Okay.
Where we hear voices coming in over yearbook photos to start. These voices are saying things like, did you hear what happened to Jackson? And did you see that video? Maybe he deserved it after what he did. That was way more than hazing. He targeted Caleb. Is it because Caleb's gay? These voices continue to play and speculate. While we are now seeing these yearbook photos being dragged into Photoshop, cut up, and appear to be placed on 3D facial renderings. And then lastly, we see a 3D printer working as it creates a mask.
Okay.
So this is your opening credit sequence. It's just all of this kind of stuff happening in the background, which it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because like at first it just seems like, oh, we're looking at yearbook photos, and then it just keeps developing, and then you see the mask and it's like, oh shit, cool.
Yeah.
Now we're at the high school and we see a memorial set up outside with a picture of Jackson at the forefront, flowers, teddy bears, cards, you know, the whole deal. A girl puts down a get well soon card and we hear a snicker from behind her.
Damn.
The girl who put down the card. I know. The girl who put the card down says the store ran out of all the sad cards. And her friend's like, no, I love your optimism.
He'll be back.
They go and sit down at a table with three other people. So here's our characters.
Okay.
We have Makani, who is the girl who put the card down. Her friend Alex, female. Darby, Rodrigo, and Zach. They're talking about what happened and how it's unfair that Caleb is getting the blame, considering he was literally on the football field when it happened.
Right.
Yet people are still speculating about it being him.
Hmm.
They discuss who it could be. Is it Macon? Nah, he's too dumb. Zach offers up his father as an option. This theory has something to do with his father wanting the farmland that the Jackson's family lives on.
Mm.
Caleb walks into the cafeteria and you can tell that he doesn't know where to sit. So Darby calls out to him to be like, hey, you can come sit with us.
Sure.
And they all get acquainted. This is their first time meeting. Suddenly a girl calls for attention, everybody's attention in the middle of the cafeteria. Her name's Katie, and she is the student body president. And she said she feels she'd like to share some light in these dark times that they are experiencing.
Oh,
so
God.
She wants to read an excerpt from her admission essay to Cornell.
No. Like, you don't have to. That's okay. I fear Girlie. You're putting a target on your back. Like, this person isn't caught yet, and I fear they might kill you over this.
They might. She announces that this essay is about oppression.
Oh.
So Katie begins talking about intolerance and oppression before heading into this next part, which goes as follows. Get ready.
Oh, God.
We have a student here at my school who is an outer space enthusiast, but that's not the only thing about this student that's alien. His name, or her name, depending on the day, is Darby. Born Justine Darby, this student showed me the meaning of courage when at age 11, she came out to our school as she, he, and they. And now every day in my mind, I applaud her, him, and them.
Where did this begin and how did it end this way? Like, what is going on? One of the cringiest things to me is people like thinking they're being like, what's the word for it? Like, think that they're being, I don't know.
I know what you mean, but I don't know the word.
Yeah. They're being so like nice and sensitive to other people's things. And then it's just like you're standing there and embarrassing yourself and you don't get it. And you're proving that you just don't get it. And you're making everyone uncomfortable. Like, oh my God, I'm uncomfortable.
Yep. And Darby obviously looks wildly uncomfortable at this whole speech. And when this, you know, section of Katie's speech finishes, Katie leads the applause.
Oh, God.
For her own speech. And the entire cafeteria just joins in because, you know, sure, why not? But she's not done.
Oh.
She goes on to say that they love every version of Darby and they also love every version of Caleb. And they must spread love because that's the only way to fight hate. And they must show up at the memorial tomorrow to share that love.
It's giving. She doesn't even go here.
Right?
Like you can sit down. Yep. Sit down.
Darby obviously is banging their head onto the table a few times, like, holy shit, what just happened?
Yeah.
So this friend group, this main group that we have, they head outside. It's the end of the day now. And when they get to Zach's car, they see that the side of it is spray painted with "property of Sanford family fucks." Zach just sighs and says, well, it is factual. My dad is a fuck. And the rest of them kind of look at him with a little bit of pity, but Zach isn't really seeming to be that bothered. He just hits them with "want to smoke?" And they're all like, yes, absolutely. Yeah. So they jump into the car and pass around a joint. Then when they go to pull out of their parking spot, another car cuts them off and then flips them off.
Oh.
Alex says, speaking of most likely to kill, this guy's name is Oliver Larson. And we get the vibe that this friend group doesn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later that night, Makani is sitting at the dinner table with her grandmother. Her grandmother wants to know if she's all right because clearly all this stuff that's happening must be dredging up some bad memories from Makani's past. She urges her to just focus on her college applications. Makani replies with, what's the point? All they have to do is Google my name, my real name, and then all that financial aid and friends I might have made is just bye. So what's the point?
I fear I want to Google it. What's the story?
Right? I fear I want to know.
Yeah.
Makani's grandmother tells her that she needs to stop blaming herself for what happened. And that's the end of that. So we're kind of left with some weird lore dangling in the air that we don't know much about.
Okay.
Now, this next part uses a song that I'm actually now obsessed with. It's called Wasteland by Tierra Whack. I just wanted to throw that in there because I love when I find a new song to listen to from a movie.
Yes.
And Makani is in bed with her headphones in, and she's writing pen to paper in a notebook when her phone chimes. It's a text from Ollie that says, new poem, ? She doesn't reply. Instead, she just scrolls through photos on her phone. Some of them are pictures of her and Ollie. They're romantic photos. And this is the same guy from the parking lot earlier.
Okay. Yep. I was like, hello, Oliver. Okay, okay.
Makani rolls over to go to bed and her phone buzzes with another message from Ollie that says, you can't ignore me forever. We get an exterior shot of Makani's house here just to establish the passing of time.
No, we can't do that because that means she's going to die. She has a grandma.
She has a grandma. She can't die. What the hell? So we head back into Makani's bedroom where she's fast asleep, but she seems to be having a dream. We're getting flashes of a bonfire and hearing girls laughing. There's also a flash of Makani with the word bitch written on her forehead. Makani wakes up to the sound of a bell ringing. She knows that this means that her grandmother is sleepwalking. There's a bell on her grandmother's bedroom door so that she can be alerted anytime this happens.
Oh.
She goes out into the kitchen and there are dishes out. The oven is wide open. And then she realizes the front door is wide open as well. She looks outside calling for her grandmother but gets nothing in response. When she turns back around, her grandmother is standing directly behind her with a blank stare.
Of course.
Makani's scared, but gently goes, you know, wake her up. And when her grandmother comes to, she looks around the kitchen in disbelief that she could have done all of this in her sleep. And it's kind of sad. Like,
but did she, do we get the vibe that she really did? Or is it possible?
We do get the vibe that she did.
Oh, that's really scary. Like a different type of scary.
Right, exactly. The next morning, we are getting ready for the memorial service for Jackson at the church. We are with Katie, who is dressed in her altar slash server clothes. I don't know what that, like, you know that gown? I don't know what it's called. That, like, an altar server wears. It's like a white cloak kind of vibes.
Okay, I can picture it.
Yeah, she's getting ready. She's laying out programs out on the pews. And she's talking to another altar server who's up in the balcony about what happened and who could have done this. This person isn't responding, though. And at one point, Katie asks a question and looks up and realizes that the other server is gone. She looks around confused, but then her phone dings and she takes it out of her pocket. It's a text from Marcus that says, "Sick as a dog, think you can handle the service solo?" So Marcus is who she believes she was just talking to. Suddenly, a voice, her voice, begins to play throughout the empty church. Katie turns to look at the projector that had been showing pictures of Jackson, but now is showing a picture of a podcast page. The podcast is called Whitewash, and the things that Katie is saying are questionable at best. I'll just give you her opening line here.
Wait, is this real? Like, she has a podcast called Whitewash?
This is a real thing.
Oh my God.
And her opening line here is, "Some races have higher IQs than other races. It's basic science. Look it up." And yes, this is the Katie from earlier in the cafeteria. So
I'm shocked that she would have that because she's giving like, I mean, obviously we know the what she really is like and it's all for show or whatever. But it's wild that she has a podcast when she seems to care so much about coming off as so woke to everybody.
Well, we'll get into that in a second because here we go. Next thing we know, there is somebody standing right behind Katie. Of course, dressed the same as her, wearing a mask that looks like her face.
I love that. I love this whole thing of like the mask is the victim's faces. That's
right.
I can't believe that I've not seen that done before.
Yeah, I think it's really cool.
Yeah.
She immediately starts trying to defend herself, saying she recorded one episode of this podcast, but no one was supposed to hear it. Her double pulls out a knife. Katie tries to run, but the door is locked. So the killer catches up to her easily and slices her through the stomach with a knife. Katie tries to crawl away, smearing her blood all over the floor of the church. Meanwhile, her podcast is still playing over all of this scene, and there's just more and more bullshit spewing out of her mouth. Mm-hmm. Just white supremacy bullshit. Mm-hmm. Katie makes her way into a confessional, kind of symbolically, and slams the door. The killer begins poking the knife through the door of the confessional repeatedly before shoving the knife through one last time and just leaving it there. And then it goes silent. Katie calls 911 from inside the confessional and immediately says that there's a killer here and forcing her to say offensive hate speech at knife point.
Oh my God.
It's at this moment that the killer bursts through the other side of the confessional, grabs Katie and pushes her face into the knife that they had left peered like through the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
And the knife goes straight through her mouth and out the back of her head, which also feels symbolic for her hate speech, which it's funny. I just am now literally in this moment picking up on the confessional and the knife in the mouth. Like, I'm like, oh wait, that's actually really good.
Love. It's interesting that they're setting up these victims as like bad people.
Mm.
because you never want to be on this like side of the murderer and be like, heck yeah, kill them, because like that's not how life should work,
right?
But also it's like, why are you making me hate all of these people that are being killed?
Yeah,
it's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it's very like vigilante killer kind of vibes.
Yeah.
So outside, people are arriving for the memorial service, but the door's locked, so the pastor shows up to let everybody inside. The group of people walk into the church to still, yes, the sound of Katie's hate speech playing over the speakers, and Katie in her blood-soaked cloak hanging from the ceiling above the altar.
Dang.
We cut a yeah,
and like the white cloak. That's
yes,
kind of cool. I mean, I hate so to say good. It, but kind of cool.
pretty cool. Not gonna
Killer's
lie,
got style. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. We cut away from the church while a news broadcast plays. It's a press conference with the police, who are aware of the facts. This is a killer who seems to be hell bent on exposing intimate information about their victims. Both victims were seniors at the same high school, and there are also rumors that the killer is wearing masks that look like the victims.
Mm-hmm.
We see Makani and her grandmother watching this broadcast, and then cut to Makani Googling her own name. She types Makani Young into the search bar. Nothing of interest seems to come up, so Makani backspaces Young and instead types in Sun Woo.
Oh.
We don't get to see what's on the screen, but we do get flashes of fire and a shot of Makani handcuffed being led to a police car in her head.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Makani snaps out of it when her phone rings. It's Rodrigo. She picks up and can immediately tell something's off with Rodrigo. He brushes it off, saying he has a cold and he's taking some cold medicine, so he's, you know, a little out of it. But then we get a shot of him placing a bottle of pills back into a medicine cabinet. Definitely not cold medicine.
Okay.
He just suddenly starts ranting about how he wishes his life was normal, you know, without murder. He just wants to have a girlfriend and go to college and be normal.
I mean, sure.
Valid enough, I suppose.
Yeah.
Makani cuts him off, saying, "You keep calling me, Ro, when I know you really want to call Alex."
T.
Rodrigo says he's just scared, and Makani tells him that he hides it well, to which he replies, "Well, seems like we can't hide anything anymore, can we?" Now we get a shot of the Google page, where we can see mugshots of Makani and some news articles about her being arrested. So here's what I want to say. The first time I watched this, I did not see any of the context, like, because it's a bunch of articles, and then there's, like, you know how a Google page has, like, a few lines under each article.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave this up to you. When I paused it and read everything, there is one line that tells you what she did. I did not know watching this.
Oh, my God.
I think the average viewer is not going to see this.
Yeah.
Because it's quick. But if you pause it, you can read it. It obviously is going to come to light eventually.
Oh, it does come to light later.
Yes. So,
and is it like a moment where it feels like it should, like it's the right moment to come to light, or does it not matter?
Yes, later.
Okay, then I'll wait.
You'll wait? Okay.
Yeah.
So there is a line, but I don't think the average viewer is catching on.
Sure.
So this is actually where I put our first score check-in.
Okay. So we just have Jackson and Katie.
Yes.
First of all.
I know what you're going to say.
You know, and I think you're thinking the same way. Like, we aren't these terrible people.
Right.
We wouldn't be doing these terrible things. So I'd like to think that I would not be targeted in the first place. So that's going to help me out a bit here. But I think I also have to put that kind of aside and consider the physicality of the kills.
Absolutely.
The first one, I do think... I would just immediately go running. Like, as soon as I see that my car is gone, I'm just running.
Right, because the car being gone is crazy. Like, I get maybe Jackson is in a headspace where he thinks this is somebody fucking with him. He probably doesn't think he's about to get murdered.
Yeah.
But, like, how the hell did they get your car gone?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's why he put down the 911, because he was afraid, like, oh, this person knows something and I'm going to get in trouble for it. I wouldn't care. Like, if I did something bad and, like, I realized I was being targeted for that and someone's messing with me, my brain does go to murder. I'm like, oh, I'm going to be murdered. So, like, I would still, like, Mm-hmm. I would stay on the phone. I don't care what I'm getting in trouble for. I just don't want to die. So maybe I'd like my mistake could be, though, like before running, I might run back into the house to grab the phone and take it with me and just start running, which I don't know if that would be. I don't know. But that person seems to think be like the killer seems pretty confident that they're going to follow them to the closet. I think they're already in the closet. So I probably could get away with like grabbing the phone and running. But then it's like, okay, then it's going to be a chase because I just know I'm not going up and following the pictures and everything. So okay. I would probably, I'm going to give myself like a 70. I'm somewhere in the 70s right now for Jackson because then it would just come down to like if I'm going to be outrun. Yeah. For Katie, I think the physicality of her death, I would be a little bit more susceptible to.
Right.
I do want to factor in, like, again, I wouldn't be these people. So yeah. I'm gonna give myself like a 78% for this first act because I don't think I'd be in their situation. If I was, I would do some things differently. The majority of what I'm bringing myself down for is just like the attack in the church. Like, right. I don't know if there's much I could do if I'm in that situation.
I mostly just put wouldn't do bad shit to the side.
Sure.
And I didn't do this on purpose, but for Jackson, I gave myself a 66, and for Katie, I gave myself a 34, which means I end up at a 50.
Okay.
Like a straight 50, which feels fair because the physicality of, specifically with Katie's, that one I feel like I'd be dead.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, she's like, the door is locked. She tries to run. I mean, maybe running into the confessional wasn't smart, but at the same time, she didn't really have anywhere to go. And then Jackson, I agree with you. I feel like I hopefully would have run.
Yep.
At that point. But okay. Not a bad start. So the next day, we are at the police station. Makani asks Alex what she thinks they're asking in there. Alex replies with, "If you're white, what's good on TV? If you're brown, why are you murdering?" The police are questioning students at the school, trying to get information on these murders. And our whole friend group is here waiting for their turn. Currently, Macon is being questioned, and they seem to think he's the most likely suspect. Because, you know, football players get brain damage and just start stabbing people. It happens. Sure. Yeah, it happens. All the time. Zach's like, "No, you guys are looking at the wrong side of the table," referring to the sheriff. If he solves a series of murders, it could make him look like the hero. Or it could just be the most obvious answer. Alex looks across the room at Ollie, who is also sitting in the waiting room. "Tragic past, no friends. Could be him," she says. Rodrigo's like, "Tragic past, no friends. Well, that could be us too." Caleb butts in to be like, no, you guys are just who you are. You don't have any secrets." And Alex elbows Rodrigo and says, "Unless there's something you want us to know," which is a little interesting considering what we know Rodrigo said about Alex the night before. She honestly seems to be giving a little bit of some flirty energy to Rodrigo. And it's like, okay, buddy, why don't you go for it, right?
Exactly.
So the sheriff comes out and calls up Zachariah Sanford. Zach gets up to go have his turn being questioned, but the sheriff looks at him and says, "Your dad's lawyer just invoked your constitutional rights, so you're free to go."
Oh.
Zach shakes his head, kind of embarrassed because the entire room just heard that he got to leave without being questioned. And he heads outside where his dad is now waiting for him. Zach approaches the car and tells his dad that he drove himself, so he'll just go in his own car. But Zach's dad doesn't say a word. Instead, he just like points at the passenger seat. And so Zach reluctantly gets in.
And Zach is the one that had the spray painted car.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Zach's dad just kind of starts going off on him here for seemingly no reason. He seems mad that he came to the police station at all. He starts talking shit about his friends, and then he gets mad at him for smelling like marijuana. Mm-hmm. He calls him stupid and then glances at Zach's car, telling him to get that graffiti buffed out because it's just so embarrassing. Zach gets up and leaves. So you can tell that relationship isn't the best.
Yeah, yikes.
In the waiting room, it seems to be much later now, and it's just Makani and Ollie. Suddenly, Ollie speaks up, but he's just kind of talking to himself, role-playing a conversation between Makani and Ollie. He goes as follows. "Hey, Ollie." "Hey, Makani. I'm sorry I'm staring. I got nothing to do till my brother's off. Did you cut your hair?" "Yeah, I cut it myself." "Also, I'm sorry I've been ignoring you since school started." Makani finally cuts him off and is like, "What are you doing?" And Ollie gets up and moves over to sit next to Makani. He sits down and goes, "I have a theory. I think you like being around somebody who's more fucked up than you are." How sweet. He's like, it made you feel normal, but then school started and you had to go back to pretending that you're normal, which you're not. And he clarifies that this is a compliment. He knows that being seen with her would endanger her image. The sheriff walks out into the waiting room and says to Ollie, hey, little brother, did you see anybody take my taser?
Oh.
And he's like, nope.
Oh, no.
Didn't see that. He then calls McConaughey into the office. He questions her, recognizing that she just recently moved here, but he doesn't seem to know anything about her past. He asks the usual questions and then lets her go.
Okay.
On her way out, McConaughey looks at Ollie and says, let's get out of here.
Good.
We cut to the two of – I know, right? Yeah. We cut to the two of them and in Ollie's car driving down the road. Ollie asks if there's something that she wants to talk about, and McConaughey says, no, let's just do what we always do. Ollie lights a cigarette and McConaughey puts a cassette into the player, which this is an old car, obviously, because it has a cassette. It has a cassette player still in it.
My first car had a cassette player. It was like a 2000. Mm-hmm. And I literally had like a cassette Bluetooth, not Bluetooth. It's not, that's not what that is because it has a wire. Like it was like a cassette with a wire that went into my phone.
I know you're talking about. Yes.
I wasn't cool and I didn't like play tapes. I just like had this one wired cassette right to my phone so I could like play some Taylor.
I'm pretty sure my friend had one of those. I know exactly what you're talking about. I love that. They just ride in silence. And honestly, it seems so nice. As a self-proclaimed passenger princess, this is like my ideal date right here. Like literally just show up. I'll get in your car and we just drive. That's it. That's what
beautiful.
I want.
Love that.
Eventually, they pull over to the side of the road and have to duck to avoid the police. There's a curfew in place. And after staring into each other's eyes for some time, they give in and they start making out.
Okay.
Cutesy.
Wait, is this giving like first time or no?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
No.
It's been a thing over the summer.
Right. McConaughey looks at Ollie and says, you're the only one who lets me disappear.
Hmm.
He responds with, I missed this. So there is your confirmation.
Yep.
In the background, we see a figure sprinting toward the car, but the two of them don't see it yet.
Oh my God. Hello.
Right? You're like, it's a horror movie.
Yes.
The figure slams into the car, but then just keeps running. And the moment has been ruined, unfortunately. There's a bunch of kids, like high school kids, excitedly running down the street. And they're like, what the fuck? What the fuck's going on? But McConaughey then gets a text. She looks at Ollie and says, looks like Zach's going to be the next one murdered.
Oh, casual.
She shows Ollie her phone with a picture of a house with text over it that says, secret party. She completes her thought with, by his dad.
Oh, okay. Yes. That's why we're casual.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, boy. But you've got to have a party.
Right. We have to go to this party. We have to go. So we do. We pull up to a full-blown mansion. Zach's family has money.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Of course. Outside, there's a guy named Dave who seems to be running his own solo Uber service. He's handing out flyers and telling people, don't drink and drive. Like, I'll drive you home. Just call Dave. It's really bizarre. Okay. But it's happening. It's certainly happening. Ollie and McConaughey head into the party, and we begin to hear some interesting lines, like we're overhearing conversations. Here's a few. They hire illegals to work the slaughterhouse, and they don't pay them. I post dick pics online.
Oh.
I have a YouTube channel where I try to sing opera. Those are just a few things that we're overhearing.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah. Alex screams when she sees McConaughey has arrived and pulls her in to sit with the friend group. Ollie stays back and McConaughey mouths a like sorry to him.
I know.
You're like, what the fuck?
Honestly, like right now though is a bad time to like try to get him in the group because they low-key think he's like killing people.
Right.
So like exactly. I do get it like with that added layer, but it can't be him because it's like when everyone thinks it's you, it's not you when it's a movie. If he's clearly just misunderstood, that would be a wild twist if it was him.
Right?
Okay.
McConaughey sits down with the group and asks, like, what's going on? Why are people telling each other secrets?
Mm.
Zach waltzes over in a red silk robe and says, genius, right? By admitting the one thing the killer is using against us, we're taking away his only weapon.
Oh.
Which is, like, not the worst idea. That's what they meant by secret party is,
oh my God,
share don't, your secrets party.
Don't tell me, but do you know what your secret would be?
Ooh, no, I don't. I would have to think about either. That.
I don't either. I would too. That's good for both of us. That's just
I know,
like,
right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure I know what mine would be.
Oh, yeah, I have some really dark like stuff in my past.
Oh my God,
luckily.
No.
Luckily, no.
Yeah, same.
So Alex notices that Ollie is still standing and staring at the group, and she asks, can we help you? All in black, school shooter style icon, you keep looking at us. She says some more terrible stuff before Ro butts in to say, yeah, everyone knows you're a sociopath.
Oh.
They laugh, and Ollie just walks away.
Ha ha.
Ha ha, hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Alex decides that she would like to share a secret of her own with the group. She says, I have a secret crush on, and pauses for dramatic effect, before pointing at Rodrigo.
Okay, girly, it's not secret.
Yeah, right? She compliments him a bit, and Zach is like, hell yeah, love this. This is fun. Rodrigo, what's your secret? But yeah. Rodrigo's obviously kind of sitting there a little dumbstruck because we know he has a crush on Alex. Oh my God, the tea. He just lets out a same. Like, just like, same. Alex, like, cute. Oh, right? Alex is like, oh, really? And then it's just kind of awkward, and we move on to Makani's secret. So it's like, oh, okay.
What do we do now?
Now what? Makani says that she writes poetry, and Zach says that he's not going to graduate. Everyone's secrets are just coming out. Zach continues on that his GPA is too low, and he's not going to be able to graduate, but that's not his real secret. He pulls a gun out of his back pocket.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So a bunch of people see this and they're scared for obvious, yes, understandable reasons. And yeah. Zach's like, guys, it's cool. It's chill. Don't worry about it.
What do you mean?
No, he goes, the only thing it's loaded with is meaning. He puts the gun in his mouth and everybody screams as he pulls the trigger and nothing happens. Zach takes the gun out of his mouth and blows some smoke rings into the air. People all sigh in relief because they're like, oh, cool, dude. Like, that's awesome.
It's giving the lighter in the menu, the gun lighter in the menu, where we, like, think that he's going to be like, yeah, ooh, and then he just lights the candle.
Yep.
Ugh.
Similar vibes, for sure. So Zach's putting on a show now because he is like, this brings us to tonight's main event. And he stands up on a table and gives us a little speech. He says that he knows that everyone here laughs at him and makes fun of him and, you know, tags his truck. People think that his father is a horrible person, and it seems that Zach actually agrees.
Mm-hmm.
Zach backs into a dark alcove and claps his hands. Lights turn on, and we see that he's surrounded by a collection of sorts. It is the 10th largest Nazi memorabilia collection in all of North America.
Oh, I'm assuming his dad's.
Yeah.
That is wild.
Wild. This collection has many weapons, among other things, and Zach is excited to share that he's actually converted a large chunk of this collection into pipes, hookahs, and bongs. Hence the gun from earlier.
Wait. Okay. Kind of slay.
Kind of, right? You're like, am I allowed to say this is actually kind of slay? He starts passing around all these devices. He grabs a gas mask, like holds it into the air as he proposes a toast. He goes, the 1% is burning down the world so they can stay warm. I say, let it burn down them too. While we burn down Highway 420. Okay. People cheer as he puts the gas mask over his face, pulls it off, and blows out more smoke.
Yeah.
And we enter a montage of people using Nazi memorabilia as bongs, hookahs, and pipes. Wow. And it's like not something I thought I'd ever see, but here we are.
That's what I'm like. I'm like, this is not where I thought I was going to be today, but here I am.
But here we are. It's kind of insane. During this montage, we see Rodrigo slip a bottle of pills out of his pocket and take one, but we just move on. It's just like one little quick shot.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, Alex and Rodrigo back themselves into a secluded room, making out. They share some sweet words, some sweet moments, have their fun, and then head back out into the party.
Okay.
Alex is like, okay, so I'll see you back with the others. And Rodrigo's like, yeah, like, thank you. And Alex is like, did you just thank me? And Rodrigo's like, oh, yeah, no, I didn't do that. That'd be stupid. It's very awkward. It's so weird. Alex just kisses him, walks away. It's cute, honestly. No, they're cute.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's like not like a ick awkward moment. It's like a cute awkward moment.
Exactly. No, it's, yeah. It is cute. Rodrigo looks down on the floor and he sees a pill lying by his feet and he looks a little nervous. He leans down to pick it up. He looks at the pill in his hand and then back at the floor. Suddenly, he's seeing tons of pills scattered all over the floor.
Oh.
They lead in a path-like fashion to a bottle of pills. Rodrigo picks them up, and as he's looking at this bottle of pills, he hears phones dinging all around him.
Uh-oh.
A girl looks at him holding up her phone and says, did you make this? We don't see what's on her phone, but based on other rumors that we're hearing around the room, it seems like Rodrigo's secret of taking drugs is now out into the world. Next thing we know, the lights go out. Now, we see the image that had been sent to the room, and it's a weird, like, meme of Rodrigo regards to, like, taking fentanyl. Like, it's just, like, a weird thing that's being sent around. And people are pulling out their phone flashlights, trying to illuminate the room, when one guy pans over somebody in a black hoodie wearing a Rodrigo mask.
Oh, my God. In front, every, like, we're just in the middle of a party.
Yes.
That's insane.
Yes. He screams out to the room like what he sees, and everybody begins to panic because the killer is here.
Yeah.
Rodrigo's running and calling for Alex, but the killer's following him down a dark hallway while everybody is running and screaming in the other direction. Rodrigo comes upon what looks like a closet and runs inside, closing the door behind him and locking it.
First of all, no. Don't go. There's so many people. Go with the herd.
Right? Why are you going against the flow here? I don't know.
But like, that's weird that it locked, the closet locks from the inside.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who knows why?
Yeah.
This door has like slats in it so you can see out into the hallway, like not super well, but you can kind of see like shadows and stuff. And Rodrigo does his best to stay quiet as the masked figure walks by the door. But of course, his phone dings.
Oh my God.
His cover is blown at this point. So he whips out the flashlight to see if there's anything in the closet that can help him. He notices a vent on the wall. As he's running toward it, the killer starts to smash down the closet door. And it takes enough time that Rodrigo is able to crawl inside this vent. The killer just looks at him in the vent before turning and walking away. Rodrigo pauses for a moment, feeling a little confused.
Yeah, like I thought we had something here.
I thought we had something. What a mood. But then he continues to crawl down the vent when a knife starts poking through the sides of said vent.
Oh.
Ew, yeah. Rodrigo screams as he tries to dodge the blade, and he's able to burst out of the vent on the other side. He's outside now, and he begins to stumble away from the house when a taser pierces him in the back, and he falls into a fountain. The killer walks up to him, pulls him out of the fountain, takes out a bottle of pills, and begins to force the pills down Rodrigo's throat. Rodrigo's coughing and spitting out the pills when the killer pulls out a knife, slicing him in the throat and pushing him back into the fountain. The water turns red as the killer walks away. R.I.P. Rodrigo.
This is a wild reason for the killer to, like, kill him. Like,
right. What? This one takes a bit of a turn, I feel like.
Yeah, because I don't know, like, I feel, that's just, like, sad to me. Like, someone with a drug addiction,
right.
Like, how did you get there? Like, clearly, like, you've been through stuff and you're still trying to get through. Like, it's not like, if you have a drug addiction, it doesn't equal bad person to me. So I'm like, okay, what?
Right. Like, we had a guy that beat someone up, a girl who's a blatant racist, and then a guy who has a drug addiction?
Yeah. So like, now I'm like questioning things a little for sure.
Right. Exactly. Now, I don't know how much time passes here. We had a few establishing exterior shots of like a field. And we also see the sign in front of the high school that says school closed through October. And then we see the group of friends, minus Rodrigo, sitting outside on a clear night looking pretty sad. And we have some soft emo music playing and none of these characters are talking to one another. Alex is crying and looking at pictures of Rodrigo in a yearbook. Zach is smoking a joint. Darby is using an app on their phone mapping out constellations in the sky. And Makani's just kind of staring into space.
Yeah.
Alex turns the page of the yearbook and sees a photo of Ollie. She stops and just stares at it for a moment. Next thing we know, Makani's waking up in her bed, and you get a shot of her face and then a shot of what she's looking at. Ollie is still asleep beside her.
Oh.
Oh.
Yeah. I was scared that it was going to be her grandma.
Grandma just like, hey. Yeah. Now, again, more time passes. School's back in session, and tonight is the first football game in 3 weeks. Inside the school hallways, we see excited football players, cheerleaders. People are in good spirits. But then we see the friend group walk in, and they don't look as happy. Yeah. Darby lets out a, well, I guess everyone else has moved on. That's the crazy thing about death, right? Like, when the world just keeps moving around you, and you're like, yes. I don't know, this is my entire life.
Yeah, it makes no sense. It's like, no, we need to just, like, sit here for the rest of our lives now. I was like, right. Sorry.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Alex tells the group that, well, she knows who did it. She says this as she glares across the hall at Ollie.
Of course.
Ollie stands in front of his locker where somebody has spray painted the word murderer over it. So clearly he is the favorite.
Mm-hmm.
At the football game later that night, we're still talking about Ollie. We jump in mid-conversation, but it seems like Makani has been defending Ollie a bit, and Alex just doesn't understand why. Makani doesn't think it's fair to speculate when they don't have all the facts, but Alex is confident because of what happened at the party. She and Rodrigo were talking shit to Ollie, and then an hour later, Rodrigo was dead. Alex doesn't let up. She knows his brother's a cop, Ollie's brother is a cop, and yep. would have access to tasers, and it would be easier for him to, you know, get off. It just makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Zach also says that this would explain how the killer was able to find Katie's anonymous podcast. Cops have access to ISPs. I don't exactly know what an ISP is, but I assume it's just some kind of internet yeah. tracking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, sure, whatever you say. Alex tells Makani that she doesn't understand because she wasn't here growing up. Ollie was a disturbed kid back in the day. She asks Makani if she even knows what happened to Ollie's parents. Makani gets up and leaves, and when she gets home, she gets a text from Ollie that says, "Can I see you?" Makani shakes her head and doesn't reply. Now, Grandma's coming downstairs with a suitcase. She's going to participate in a sleep study, so Makani's going to be here alone.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, okay. So, I know. I'm happy that the grandma is going to be safe. Oh, my mm-hmm. God. What if it's the grandma?
That would be amazing.
No, I'm happy that grandma's going to be safe, but, like, we know what this means. Like,
right.
She's going to be attacked.
Right. And as she's leaving, she's like, "You're going to stay with Alex tonight, right?" Makani's like, "Yeah, yeah, I was just texting her about it, but we know they just had a fight." So, like,
yeah,
it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
The next day, Makani is laying in bed, window open, light pouring in while she reads a book. I honestly Cute. Cannot express how peaceful this looks.
Yeah, like, it just that looks, sounds amazing.
It really does look so – I was jealous watching it. I was like, damn, why isn't that me right now?
Love.
The doorbell rings, and when she goes to see who it is, it's Ollie. He says, "I thought I'd take you on a trip to the ocean." Makani's like, "Well, that's like 1,000 miles away, so – and Ollie's like, no, that's not the one I'm thinking of." The two of them are in the car now, driving somewhere. Eventually, we pull up to a sign that says "Property of Sanford Family Farm" as we take a turn onto a dirt road that goes straight through a cornfield. Ollie parks the car and gets out, stepping onto the hood and reaching out his hand for Makani's, and the two of them stand on the top of the car, and Ollie tells her to look out across the corn. I guess this is his version of the ocean. And I will say it truly does look like an ocean of corn because all you can see is corn. Like, it's literally as far as your eye can see.
Yeah.
Corn.
Okay.
So it does look pretty cool. Not going to lie.
Okay. I was like, this could be like cringe or cool. Just depends on how they shoot it. So, yeah.
It was shot cool. It
yeah,
was.
Yeah, yeah.
And honestly, if I weren't a horror girly, I would think this was peaceful. But mm-hmm. I feel like if you're a horror girly, you know that a cornfield
exactly.
is a cornfield. And
something's scary. In there. Mm-hmm. Somebody is in your cornfield.
For sure. They sit down on the top of the car talking about life before they eventually begin to make out again. And when Ollie is on top of Makani, he looks at her and says, "I think you love secrets. You still won't tell a single soul about me," which is honestly fair. I feel like Makani, like, keeping him a secret is just not great. Like,
no, especially dragging him along. Exactly. It's like, I don't know. It sounds like it was like a whole summer thing. They have a very deep bond. It's like you gotta, your friends, if they're friends, are gonna get it. And just, you just gotta tell them.
Exactly. Exactly. They're interrupted when Ollie's phone starts ringing. It's Chris, his brother, and he's like, "Oh, I gotta take this, or he's just gonna keep calling me." Mm-hmm. So Makani gets back into the passenger seat, and when she goes to grab something off the floor, she accidentally knocks the glove box open.
Oh no.
Inside she sees a taser. Ollie starts to head back to the car, so Makani quickly closes the glove box because she doesn't want him to know that she saw that.
Mm-hmm.
Ollie gets in the car and complains about his brother, always needing to know where he is. It's as if he thinks he's his dad. Makani asks him about his parents, saying that he never talks about them. She asks what happened, and he gets real quiet. He tells her that they got into an accident. His dad died on the scene, and his mom died in the hospital the next day. He says they were drunks, but people always forget that part of the story. The story people prefer to run with is that they killed themselves in a double suicide because they didn't want to take care of their child with behavioral issues.
Oh.
Which is wild.
Yeah, wow.
So I guess that's the story that everyone at school runs with.
Like, where did that come? Like, what? Why? How does that even turn into that?
I mean, like, I guess Ollie was, like, you know, a bit of a troublemaker, and that's kind of just what people went with.
That's insane.
He continues, you know, I just think when something really terrible happens, people need someone to blame.
Mm-hmm.
No one probably gets that better than you.
Mm.
This catches Makani off guard, and she looks at him confused. He's talking about the poems. That's what her poems about, aren't they? Makani just looks at him and asks if he did a background check on her. He doesn't say anything, so she gets out of the car.
Yeah. Oh, no, but no, we're in a cornfield.
But no, we're in a cornfield. She starts to walk away from the car, but Ollie gets out behind her, calling her name, telling her to wait. He tries calling her name a few times, Makani, Makani. But when she ignores him, he lets out a, Makani Sun Woo.
Mm-hmm.
This stops Makani in her tracks. Ollie just says, I know you. I know who you are. But Makani keeps walking. It seems she actually calls that Dave Uber guy from earlier because we're in a car with him now.
Wait, Slay. Okay, Dave.
Slay, right? Dave. So Dave's doing all the talking, and Makani really isn't replying. He's telling her that he gets to see all sides of people, that when you get somebody in a car alone, you learn a lot about them.
Mm-hmm.
He says he knew Katie was talking out both sides of her mouth. She was easy to read. Mm-hmm. But he's like, Makani isn't. He says that she's a nice girl, and he likes having nice girls in the car. They pull up to Makani's house, and all the lights are out. Dave asks her if she's here all alone. Makani smartly replies, saying her parents just go to bed early. Life lesson, friends, never tell anybody that you're anywhere ever alone.
Ever, ever.
Your friends are in the bathroom, whatever it is, you're not alone.
Yeah.
Makani heads inside, and after she closes the door, she peeks out through the window and watches until Dave drives away. She was definitely a little freaked out by him.
Yeah.
She then locks the door, turns on the lights, grabs a knife, barricades her door, and gets into bed.
Oh my, okay. You know what? Why not?
Right?
Like, there's nothing really, I mean, other than a bad feeling about Dave, which I'm guessing he's fine.
Mm-hmm.
That would be so me. Like, this is so me-coded. Like, the smallest little thing, and all of a sudden, one time I did barricade my hall.
Oh, wow. Okay. Tea?
I forgot. It was that one, I think I already told you the story. I left this part out, but like that one time when this like car was like stopped outside my house, looking into my bedroom window. And that was when they like pulled, they like drove past and then backed up just to station outside my bedroom window. That night, I was like, what if they know, like they're coming back, like they found a spot and they're going to go get their people and they're going to come for me. And this was before karma too. And I literally barricaded my hallway. I forget what I used, but it was like stuff where I was like, I know I'm going to hear them trying to get past that.
Oh
and
my
then
God.
I closed and I locked. I have a lock on my bedroom door. And then I have you know what? I'm going to stop there. I'm going to stop there. I had a plan in case anything happened, but it didn't happen. So it's fine.
Oh, wow. So you were ready.
I don't mess around. Someone stops in front of my house for 2 minutes and I'm like, time to barricade.
You know what? You would survive, and that's what matters.
Yeah.
Makani falls back into her dream state again, and we see, you know, the fire, but then she wakes up. When she wakes up, she sees that the barricade in front of her door is gone and her door is open. And that the knife that she'd put on her bedside table is also gone.
Oh my God. How do you sleep through that?
Right? I don't
That's so scary to me. Are you a light sleeper?
See, I think I am. But then again, I did sleep through a fire alarm once. So.
That's insane. That would scare me. I'm happy to be a light sleeper.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently sometimes like when I'm on FaceTime with my boyfriend overnight, there's times when he wakes up from like karma barking, but I'm like just still sleeping. So I'm like, oh my God, I don't need that information in my head.
Uh-huh. She gets up and she's like calling for her grandma because like, oh, is grandma here? And no. She goes in the kitchen.
It's definitely not grandma.
If only, right?
Yeah.
She goes into the kitchen and calls 911. But instead of a 911 operator picking up on the other end, we hear her own voice coming through the receiver. And this voice says, "Not a day goes by I don't hate myself for it, Your Honor. If I could switch places and be the one who went into that fire, I would."
Oh my God, they're going to burn her. They're going to burn her alive. Also, technology is so scary because right? I feel like that could happen. Someone mm-hmm. could like take, especially with us being on the internet, someone could make our voices for sure.
Absolutely, they could. I will say this does sound like a legitimate like recording of her voice in court.
Okay. Well, yeah. That's less scary. Okay. It's an actual recording. That's yes. scary because like she's super secretive and like no one even knows like her past right. or real name. So like, of course. But okay. Because like if this person went next level and just like got the voices of everybody, who do you trust?
Right. Oh my God. Right. We can hear a fire crackling as Makani drops the phone on the floor and looks toward the living room. It appears to be on fire. When she walks through the doorway of the room, because yes, she does walk toward the room, we can see there are pictures plastered all over the walls of her mugshot, as well as pictures of a girl covered in burns. On the floor is a tape outline of a body, you know, like very classic cartoony tape outline.
Oh, yeah.
And newspapers that read, "Student charged in beach burning." When Makani leans down to pick up the newspaper, we see through the window that the killer is outside, dressed in black, wearing a mask of her face.
Mm-hmm.
When she stands back up, she sees them, and they smash the glass of the window and send a taser through the hole, hitting Makani in the stomach.
Oh.
Makani falls to the ground and the killer jumps into the living room through the broken window. Out of their pocket, the killer pulls a bottle, a red bottle of liquid to spray on Makani. And I don't know exactly what it is, but it seems like it's a flammable something or other.
Mm-hmm.
Makani remains laying on the ground while the killer picks up one of the newspapers and walks over to the fireplace, which also has fire in it.
Yeah.
Reaches in and lights that paper on fire and begins to bring that flame over to Makani. The killer is distracted by a noise outside, and when they turn to look behind them, Makani grabs their ankle and pulls them to the ground.
Nice.
We hear a voice outside calling for Makani. It's Alex, and this is enough to scare the killer away. But during their escape, their mask falls off, and it now lays beside Makani on the ground. Alex comes into the house calling for Makani, saying that her grandmother had called to check in. Remember, she was supposed to be at Alex's.
Yes.
While Makani's laying on the ground, Alex is on the phone and tells the other person that they need help. Makani begins to cry. It's Ollie. It was Ollie. You were right.
No.
They're going to know.
No, I don't think it is. I think they're doing like the scream fake out. Like you
scream.
You try to like make it. The boyfriend, not that he's her boyfriend, but try to make it the boyfriend and like really convince you, but then it twists and it's like, oh, but like, I guess it's the same vibe as like the phone falling out of Billy's like pants. And she's like, it's like, oh my God, you have a taser. It must be you. But no. But I would think the same thing. I would. Right. I'd be like, oh, shoot.
Alex doesn't know what Makani's talking about, but then she gets a buzz on her phone. And when she looks down at the incoming message, it is Makani's mugshot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of that scene. And this is where we're going to do our second score check-in.
Okay, wait.
Rodrigo and Makani's encounter, I guess.
Okay, Rodrigo really fucked up.
I know, right?
I mean, I would say, God, you got to run with the herd.
Yes, that,
I think
for sure.
He was like trying to find Alex. At one point.
Kind of. Yeah, that's definitely part of it.
I have to be honest, I wouldn't. Like, I wouldn't. I'd just be like, I'm being targeted right now. I need to get away.
Yeah.
So, like, maybe if she was being targeted, I'd be like, the stupid, let me try to save her. But, like, I'm being targeted. I need to get out of here. So,
yeah.
This one's scary. I feel like she didn't really do anything wrong here.
Right.
Makani didn't do anything wrong here. But then, you know, we're saved by the bell a bit.
Exactly.
With Alex. I'm going to stay higher still. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think I'm going to go I'm going to go like 85.
85?
Yeah.
I went 80. So like, I'm up there with you. Because I agree, like, Rodrigo, I feel like his decision making wasn't great. And then Makani, like, Alex shows up. So you just got to make it till Alex shows up, I feel like.
Yeah. Which I think is, I think, possible.
Right. So Makani wakes up in the hospital to her grandmother, Darby, Alex, and Zach standing around her. She immediately bursts into saying, "It's Ollie, it's Ollie. People are in danger," but her grandmother assures her that they already got him and that she's safe. Makani wants to know if everybody got the article from Ollie, but Darby assures her that they stopped reading it because they thought Makani would prefer to tell them herself.
Oh, that takes some... I fear I would read it. Like, right? If it was, like, even if it was my best friend, and I'm like, they probably don't want me to read this. I'm so sorry, Caitlin. I'd be reading the article
I
about
know.
You.
Listen, you know us. We love the tea. We love the lore. So we would be set with that article.
Yeah.
And then Googling more, quite frankly. It's like that would be happening. It is flashback time. So here we go. We're on a beach at night. A bonfire is glowing. Makani's wearing goggles and has the word bitch written across her forehead. Mm. We realize now that there are actually other girls in the same situation as Makani, wearing goggles with different insults written on their foreheads.
Mm.
Another girl stands above them. She says, "Okay, bitches, you think you got what it takes to win state?" So we can tell we are in some sort of hazing situation.
Yeah, again. I hate this. I hate this so much. Right? You think you hear it more in college.
Mm-hmm.
High school, I guess you see it more like in entertainment, but it's just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is real life.
Yes.
Like, this still happens in the year 2025. What are we doing?
Right, right. Like, it's beyond insane to me.
Yeah.
So a bunch of girls stand around laughing while this one girl berates the six on the ground near the fire. The main girl walks right up to Makani and says, "What's your name, bitch?" before force feeding her vodka.
Ugh.
We cut back for a moment to the hospital room where Darby and Alex look particularly perplexed at the story that they're hearing. And Darby asks Makani if these were her friends. And Makani's like, "Well, sometimes. I don't know."
Mm-hmm.
"They were seniors," she says. "It was my first year on varsity." We see more horrible images of the hazing that's happening to these girls. They're being forced to eat and drink things, having things thrown at them. Now Makani's stumbling, looking very drunk, as she walks up to another girl, also with, you know, the words on her forehead.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, "Hey, Jasmine." And this girl, also seeming to be very drunk, pushes Makani away. And in retaliation, Makani pushes her back, and she pushes her a little harder than it seems she means to, and she pushes her directly into the bonfire.
Oh my gosh.
Back in the hospital room, Makani tells her friends that Jasmine survived, but there were many burns, including major burning to her face.
Mm-hmm.
She explains that she went to trial and was acquitted, but what happened to her still follows her everywhere she goes. She got threats. Her parents got divorced. She wanted to get away from it all, so she took her mother's maiden name and moved here, wanting to be a different person. Darby, Zach, and Alex all assure Makani that this isn't going to change the way they feel about her because they know she's a good person.
Yeah.
Zach holds out a joint and says, "No more secrets between friends." And Alex looks appalled because this is a fucking hospital, as she puts it. But Zach's like, no, don't worry. I'm not actually going to smoke it. We could just, like, it's symbolic. He says, no, and I love what he says because, like, this is so me. He's like, "I'm not really good with hugs. Like, aww, this is my way." And I'm like, that's such a mood.
Valid.
But Alex pulls him into the group hug anyway, and the four of them share a nice moment.
Okay. So do her parents are alive?
Yes.
So, but she lives with her grandma.
Yeah, it seems like her parents got divorced and she just, like, wanted to get away from all of that.
Interesting.
And so she lives with her grandma now. They don't go too much into that, but that's okay. Kind of what the vibe that I get.
Then Jasmine, possible suspect, name mm-hmm. drop.
Name drop. We did get a name drop.
Mm-hmm.
So we cut to sometime later and Makani is laying in bed watching the news. A story about Ollie's arrest is playing and she's on her phone looking through photos from her past. Her parents, her swim days, her on the beach when she was younger.
Mm-hmm.
She then pulls up her contact list and pulls up Jasmine's contact. Her finger lingers over the call button, but ultimately she puts her phone down and doesn't make the phone call. Another jump in time and we find ourselves outside the Sanford Corn Maze. It's the fall festival. And Zach's dad is talking to reporters about how excited he is for the fall festival and bragging about the fact that they hired private security to keep people safe at the festival.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be really safe.
I know. He has an issue with the cops and thinks they're not doing a good enough job, so he's got his own security, blah, blah, blah. So at the high school, Makani's on the phone with Alex, and there seems to have been some sort of mix-up with who was picking up who. Zach was going to pick them up, but his dad made him work the corn maze, and Alex is in the car with some people, but they'll turn around, they'll get Makani because Makani just missed the bus. It's a whole thing.
Okay.
So We know that Makani is at the high school alone, and she's going to wait for Alex to come and pick her up.
That's great.
Right? Well, Makani's waiting in the parking lot. Her phone buzzes, and she sees that it's a text from Darby. The text reads, "Ollie is out. His brother let him go." Immediately after reading this text, Makani looks up and sees that Ollie is pulling his car into the parking lot.
Oh.
He begins to drive his car right up to her, and so she gets scared and turns and runs inside the building.
Oh,
while she's inside, she calls 911.
Good.
And she begins to tell the operator what's happening, but she hears a noise behind her, and it distracts her. She ends up running smack dab into Caleb. They share a hug as Makani is extremely relieved to see him. This next section all occurs in slow-mo.
Okay.
They share an embrace, and then Makani hears a squishy sound as she backs away from Caleb. He has a blank look on his face. We pan down to see a blade sticking out from Caleb's stomach. Caleb falls to the ground, revealing the killer standing directly behind him. Of course, wearing a mask. I think it's Caleb.
Okay.
On the mask, it's hard to like really tell.
Yeah.
The killer grabs Makani's hand and just places the bloody knife in her palm.
What?
Yeah. Just places it there. And she's just kind of stood frozen in this moment.
Uh-huh.
Down the hall, we hear a door open and a voice screaming for Makani. The killer turns and runs and leaves as Ollie runs down the hallway behind Makani. He runs up to her and asks if she's okay before attending to Caleb on the ground, who is still alive.
Oh, okay.
Darby and Alex arrive. They run inside to see Caleb on the ground and Makani holding the knife. But what's most important right now is that Makani sees a flyer on the wall for the corn maze and she gets nervous. Somehow she gets a gut feeling that the killer's going to the corn maze. I don't know like why, but she's like, oh my god, the corn maze. And they're all like, oh, the corn maze. I don't know why they know that that's where the killer's going.
They just became aware that they're in a movie.
Yes, they're like, oh, the corn maze.
Okay, whoa. I wasn't expecting Caleb to be attacked because he was like set up as a victim of someone else who was being killed. That's interesting.
Right. So, of course, the place we cut to next is the corn maze. Mm-hmm. And we see the killer walking through the corn maze, pouring more of that flammable liquid on the ground through the paths. Ollie, Makani, Darby, and Alex are all in the car together driving toward the corn maze. Darby's on the phone with the hospital checking in on Caleb, and Makani's trying to get in touch with Zach.
Mm-hmm.
When Darby gets off the phone, she tells the car Caleb's going to be okay. He's not in great shape, but he is stable. Makani just hopes that Zach's okay and asks her friends if they know which farms Zach's dad bought out, because anybody who was victimized by Zach's dad would have motive. Darby says that pretty much everyone has been wronged by Zach's father, so right. That's not going to help them all that much.
Sure.
Back at the corn maze, the killer's pulled out a lighter and is dropping it on the ground. And the corn maze is, yes, going up in flames. The friends in the car can see this from a distance, and it's pedal to the metal now. We gotta get there. Makani's phone rings, and it's Zach. He's panicked. He's saying that everything's on fire, but his dad is in the maze, so he has to go in and find him.
Ooh.
That is the last thing they hear before his phone goes dead.
Okay.
The friends finally arrive at the corn maze, and it's a shit show. The entire field is like bright orange. People are screaming, running away. It really doesn't seem like there's much they can do at this point.
Yeah, they called, like, are people, is like fire department, police,
they're there? Not there. I assume somebody's called.
Yeah,
but at that point,
because it's like a million people probably have called.
Right, exactly.
Okay,
so like I said, it doesn't seem like there's anything they can do.
Yeah,
except that is not how Makani sees it.
Okay,
just bear with me right now, okay?
Oh, gosh.
She looks at Ollie and says, well, this car's a piece of crap, right?
Oh.
Ollie looks at her and doesn't say anything. In the back seat, Alex is like, hold on. Like, what are you talking about? And Makani's like, well, we have to do something. We have to try and save Zach. And half of our class are in that maze right now. We need to find a way to go in and save them. So, yes. Makani's idea is to drive the car into the maze that is fully in flames because we can clear a path and everyone can get out.
Or you can blow up.
Literally, I've never seen a dumber decision made in a horror film in my life. They're all like, oh my God, yes, this is a great idea. So all four of them stay in the car as they drive it into the maze.
Oh.
What? What?
Wait, no, I need to know how the movie plays it though. Like, if this works... That's insane. They should blow up.
That the whole time my mind's like, don't cars explode? Don't.
Yes.
Their gas tank.
Yes.
That is my brain this entire time.
Oh, God.
But They do. They drive the car into the corn maze. And as they drive through the flames, of course, Makani's having flashbacks to Jasmine and pushing her into the fire because they are in a lot of fire at the moment. And
trauma.
Eventually, the car comes to a halt and they're like, oh, shit, we should get out of it.
Into the corn maze that's on fire with your car now.
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
So they get out of the car. And like, again, like this maze is on fire, but it's like, it's unrealistic. So there's spots where they can stand, like just.
Yeah.
It's a movie. This is one of those, it's a movie parts.
Got you.
So they step out of the car and Ollie sees that Makani is still holding that knife from earlier that the killer placed in her hands. Mm. So he runs back to the car and grabs his taser. So I guess, you know, they're armed. So that's good.
Yeah, that works against fire for sure.
Right. Yeah. You just take that taser right to the fire. They hear screams from within the maze and run toward the sound. They come across a dead body, also a group of people trying to find their way out.
Ooh.
And they do point this group of people in the direction that they came in. And it seems like the four of them are all planning to go deeper into the maze together. But Makani encourages Alex and Darby to go back and help those people find their way out.
Okay.
She and Ollie will continue further into the maze to look for people, especially Zach. Makani and Ollie continue into the maze, walking through smoke, coughing, coming across a couple dead bodies. And they eventually happen upon the killer standing face to face with Zach's dad.
Why is the killer in the fire maze? Like,
there's like a section here that's just like a wide open spot where there's no fire because, you know,
okay,
it works like that.
Sure. Yes. Okay. I'm here.
So yes, the killer is wearing a mask of Zach's father's face, and Zach's father is standing there trying to make it seem like he's a good person and like, you know, like everyone's like just like, oh, what I've done, you know, it doesn't reflect who I am. And it's actually funny right here because Makani and Ollie are watching like this like standoff happening, and Makani yells, "Hey, asshole," and they both turn and look at her. It's actually great.
I love that.
It's a great comedic moment. But only for a moment do they turn and look, because the killer quickly pulls out this like long ass sword.
Oh.
It like, I don't know what kind of sword it is. Jams it into Zach's dad's face, like up through the bottom of the chin, through the top of the head. It's like really gnarly. It's really ugly. Ollie and Makani scream as Zach's father falls to the ground dead. The killer then looks at the two of them and lets out, "Damn it." The killer starts to say, "Do you know how many times?" But then they stop and pull off their mask. "Do you know how many times I've dreamt of that moment?"
Is it? No, it's not Zach.
It's Zach.
When you were saying that he was the only one not there with them, as the friend group and like the climax is happening and everything, I was like, oh, shoot. Is it Zach? It's also, I should have maybe thought that too. When he threw the party and like he wasn't the one that was targeted at his own party and he was like the hero at the party. It's like, what the heck?
I know.
Why do you want to kill? Okay.
We'll get there, I guess.
Yeah, I'll wait.
Makani looks at him in disbelief as he continues on. "You only get to kill your dad once." He's pissed that he was interrupted. Ollie pulls out the taser and walks up to Zach saying, "Fuck you, sociopath." He pulls the trigger, but nothing happens, giving Zach the opportunity to stab him in the stomach.
Oh.
Zach tells Ollie that he's not a sociopath. Does anyone even know what that word means anymore? If I were a sociopath, I'd have zero emotional investment in the outcome. This is very, very important to me.
That's a fun line.
It is, right?
Yeah.
Makani's pleading with Zach to stop because this isn't who Zach is. But Zach tells her that no, she has no idea who he is and that he spent his whole life hiding who he was. "I was ashamed. But why? Because I was born with privilege? Why should I feel bad about that? It's not my fault."
Oh my God.
I know.
Him and Tyler from Companion, they would be besties.
He says that everybody wears masks. Everybody hides their true self, including Makani. She even changed her name to get away from her identity. "You're all putting on these fake faces. You're all hypocrites, just like my dad. But I can't hide from my dad's last name, so I'm showing these people who they are, who they really are." He wants everybody to be outed for the hypocrites that they are because he doesn't have the privilege of hiding since his father is so public about their wrongdoings. Zach then lets Makani in on his final plan. Of course, he plans to frame Makani. kill her and then claim self-defense, which seems like it would honestly work out pretty well because her fingerprints are all over the knife.
Sure, that makes sense now. Okay.
More fire, more victims. That's so you, says Zach. He's like, I could just put this all on you and no one would ever know. Ollie sits up from his spot on the ground where he's been writhing in pain and says, all no, as he shoots the taser towards Zach. He misses, but the distraction...
He misses.
He's really bad at literally everything. Aww. But luckily, this distraction gives Makani an opportunity to attack Zach with the very knife that he had attacked Caleb with.
Mm-hmm.
She stabs him in the stomach and they fall to the ground. As she's leaning over him, she says to him, you think having everything makes you the victim? She berates him for what he's done and tells him that he's the problem. He acts like everyone else is the problem, but it's him. Mm-hmm. She pulls the knife out of his chest and then stabs him one more time. She almost seems to take a little pleasure in this one. It's very, like, intense.
Yeah.
Zach dies.
Okay.
And Makani runs over to Ollie, who is still in rough shape on the ground. He's out of it and seems to be fading. Makani's apologizing to him over and over as we hear sirens approaching in the distance. So they're finally arriving.
Of course.
Of course, now they always arrive after everything in a horror film. It's so funny.
Yep.
We cut to black before opening back up on a shot of Makani and Ollie all dressed up, having their photos taken. A voiceover from Makani plays over this scene. It's one of her poems, which I will read after I describe the imagery.
Okay.
We see Caleb receiving an acceptance letter to Colorado State University for football.
Oh.
Alex gets into Manhattan School of Music. Darby puts on a NASA hat, a sign relating to the fact that they were trying to and successfully did obtain a fellowship with NASA. Makani lays in bed now, and we see her again looking at Jasmine's contact on her phone, and this time, she calls.
Nice.
We then cut to Makani on a stage in her graduation cap and gown and realize the voiceover we've been hearing has been a speech/reading that she's been giving at graduation.
Mm-hmm.
The poem that she has been reading is as follows. I said, my youth is gone, like a fire beaten out by the rain. That will never sway and sing or play in the wind again. I said, it's no great sorrow that quenched my youth in me, but only little sorrows beating endlessly. I thought my youth was gone, but all of you returned like a flame at the call of the wind. It leaped and burned, threw off its ashen cloak, and gowned itself like new. Gave itself like a secret, whispered once more to all of you. She receives a standing ovation as tears well up in her eyes, and the movie ends.
Okay.
It's kind of sweet, actually.
That is a sweet ending, but it's an interesting ending after all that.
I know.
It's really, really sweet at the end. And then it's like, oh, I feel weird because it's sweet. But this just happened for the last hour and a half.
A lot of death.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. What a wild ride.
I know.
I do love a whodunit is so fun.
This movie is so scream coded.
Like, yes.
It's the whole thing feels very like you have your friend group and it's it's one of the people in the friend group in the end. It's like it's very scream vibes.
Yeah. Yeah, which I love. Like
I know.
Especially cuz some people like hate that. They're like they're just trying to be scream. I think everyone knows they can't be scream, but we can have fun anyways.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, okay, my final survivability score, we have Zach's dad.
Mm-hmm.
And
Zach, I guess, but...
And Zach, yeah.
But he's the killer, so...
Yeah.
And then I guess just, like, putting yourself in the shoes of Makani and Makani.
I will say, Zach's dad, I'm a 0%. Like, what... You're just... Oh, yeah. You're in a cornfield, and then it's on fire, and then someone pulls out a sword, and you're dead. Like, that's that. I guess, am I supposed to think that driving into this cornfield was the right move?
Like, I'm not driving into the cornfield, so.
Yeah.
But then the killer's not being caught, and then, so it's like, ooh, it's an interesting place to think.
Honestly, I'm like a coward, so I'm not gonna do that. I'm not gonna drive into a cornfield. I'm not gonna go anywhere near this. I'm gonna call 911 and I'm gonna go and hide somewhere with my friends.
Yeah.
But then maybe, obviously, like just because 911 gets there, the police get there, doesn't mean that he's gonna be caught. Like the movie might just keep going for me then.
Right. Exactly.
This would not be like the moment that I would, I think, catch them unless he ends up coming out of the cornfield. And then it's like, then what do I do? oh, this is really hard to gauge this, in this last
right,
act.
It's tough.
I'm going to give myself a 32%.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, because I just, there's just no way I would have accomplished anything in the way that they did.
That's a good way to look know? At it.
So yeah. Then it's just all up to chance of what would happen next, and I don't know that, but I just, I know there's no way for me personally to win in this final act. So then I have to be open to like death or yeah. It just keeps going. And then like it's unknown. So because I'm on like such shaky ground in this final act, I'm just going to keep it low because they went wild with their decisions here.
They did. I went 62, which, but it like you said, it's a tricky one. Like mm-hmm. Zach's dad is like all the death for me because I'm just like, I'm not driving in mm-hmm. to the cornfield mm-hmm. and I don't know from there. Obviously, like I could still be targeted, but I don't know what that is. So like, yeah, like you said, it's kind of a tricky one.
Yeah.
But I did go with a 62 for my final act.
But that means my final score for the whole movie is 65.
Mine's 64.
Oh my God.
So 65. Let's
oh my God.
Go.
Okay. Okay.
That's no, the movies, so crazy.
The movies have to start because ever since our three act survivability, we've been 60s a lot.
Yeah.
It ends up in the 60s a lot because we have some high numbers, we have some low numbers, and then it starts to average out. 65% is interesting. But again, I think it makes sense for this type of movie.
Right. Exactly. Because it's, you know, it's the whodunit slasher genre. It's like yeah. most of the decisions I'm going to make are better, but there are a lot of situations where
yeah,
probably. So like kind of just above average, just above middle anyway. I honestly, I just want to say like I love, 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 love this movie and it's not rated super high. Right before I looked it up on Google and it has like the vast majority of reviews are 1-star reviews, which just surprises me because I think it's such a fun movie. And I'm wondering if it's coming from a place, like you said, where people are like, it's just trying to be Scream. Like,
yeah.
It is very Scream. But like, I don't know. I just love the vibe. And yes, it's cheesy. Yes, it's campy. But I love the characters in it. And just, I don't know. I think like the romance aspect of it was something I actually really loved. Like Ollie and Makani, I loved them. There was just a lot to appreciate about this movie.
The opening scene was so good. Like,
right?
I could picture it so clearly. And I just know, like, without even seeing the movie in front of me, that's my favorite scene.
That's your favorite part.
So yeah. good. I didn't expect it to, like, go full out friend group, small town, everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, based on the title, I thought it was going to be one house that was targeted. But then it opened up much more than that.
But yeah, I hope you guys all enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for listening. You can feel free to check us out on Instagram. Over there, we have all our links to all of our other stuff. And be sure, as always, to go over to the Discord and submit your survivability score. Let us know, would you survive?